All right, well, good morning, everyone. It's great to see you here. Big thanks to Domio for asking me to sit with you today and keep her seat warm while she's finishing up Sesshin at Great Vow. Hope she's had a wonderful time up there. I'm sure she has. If you look at the newsletter, you'll see my talk today is about the Dharma of Hard Choices. And it's ironic that I'm giving a talk on hard choices on May the 21st because May the 21st happens to be my anniversary. So today's my anniversary, yes. 15 years together, 14 years married. To the day, we decided to just make it easy on ourselves and get married on the same day we met, exactly 1 year later. So that was not a hard choice, it was a very easy choice. So this talk has nothing to do with that decision. But there have been some hard choices along the way, so as I'll allude to. So the impetus for this topic that I wanted to go over today, I'm sorry, there's people who may not know. My name is James. I've been a Sangha member here for a couple of years. And so people are probably, who is this guy? I thought Domio was looked different. The impetus for the topic that I want to go over today came from a number of months ago. I was working on a new musical piece. Most of you know I'm a composer. I wanted to write a symphonic poem, which is a 19th century style of writing that people like Franz Liszt and others, where they would take a scene, an image, or a poem, or a story, and they would set it to music, and not like literally set it to music, but try to evoke the imagery of the scene or the poem through the music itself. So, and I wanted to write something like this. So I'm like, I need a story. I need a good story. What's a good story? And since a lot of my compositions are centered around Zen and Buddhist teachings, I'm like, well, it's got to be a Zen story or a Buddhist story of some way, in some way, shape, or form. And so I settled on a story called Seijo and Her Soul Are Separated, or Seijo and Her Two Souls, or Seijo and Her Soul. It goes by a couple of different names. A story that I came across through reading one of the koan collections, The Gateless Gate. I'll just read the koan and then I'll read the story to you. It's quite a fun story. Let's see, where am I? So this is case 35 in the Mumon Kan, The Gateless Gate. I'm reading out of Koun Yamada's translation and commentary. Case 35, the case. Goso, Master Goso, asked a monk, Seijo and her soul were separated. Which is the real Seijo? Mumon's commentary. If you realize the true one in this, you will understand that getting out of one husk and entering another is just like a traveler staying at an inn. If you have not realized it, don't rush about wildly. When earth, water, fire, and wind are suddenly about to decompose, you'll be like a crab which has fallen into boiling water and is struggling with its seven arms and eight legs. At that time, don't say I didn't warn you. It's funny, little koans. So anyway, I read that koan in the verse, and I'm like, what is he talking about? Seijo and her soul were separated. And so thankfully, Koan Yamada provides us with the story in his commentary, his Teisho on the case. This is a Chinese legend from the Tang period. Once upon a time in the province of Ko, there lived an old man named Chokan. Chokan loved his daughter Sei very much. She was very beautiful, and Chokan used to tease her when she was still a child, saying that her beauty matched that of her cousin, the handsome Ochu. Just about the time that the two cousins realized they were in love with each other, Chokan announced his choice of another man as a husband for Sei. The young lovers were heartbroken. Ochu left town, setting off on a small boat. He had rowed a distance when he noticed someone running along the bank, waving to him. To his great joy, he found that it was Sei, who had followed him. They decided to travel to a far-off land and make a life together. A few years later, when Sei had become the mother of two children, she realized, for the first time, how deep the parents' love is. Her conscience began to bother her about the way she had treated her beloved father. Her husband, Ochu, had also regretted what they had done to Chokan, suggesting that they return to their homeland and ask for his forgiveness. When they arrived in the province of Ko, Sei remained on the boat, while Ochu went to apologize to Chokan and tell him what had happened. The old man listened incredulously. Finally, he asked Ochu, "Who are you talking about?" The young husband replied, "Your daughter, Sei." "But Sei never left home," the old man exclaimed. "Shortly after you went away, she became ill and is still confined to her bed. She hasn't uttered a word since you left." "You must be mistaken," Ochu replied. "Sei followed me, and we went together to a far-off country. We are married, and we have two children. She is in excellent health and wants to see you again and ask your forgiveness for running away and marrying without your permission. If you don't believe me, come down to the boat and see for yourself." The old man was reluctant, so Ochu went alone to bring Sei back to her father's house. In the meantime, Chokan went into the bedroom in the back of the house to tell the sick Sei what had happened. Without a word, the invalid Sei rose from her bed and rushed out to meet the approaching Sei, and the two became one. Chokan said to his daughter, "Ever since Ochu left, you have been silent and lifeless, as though your soul had fled." Sei told him, "I didn't know I was homesick in bed. When I heard that Ochu had left, I followed his boat as if in a dream." So, and there's more commentary, but that's the end of the story. Kind of a fantastical story, right? Its veracity as being true or not, being beside the point, of course, as in most things that are important. So when we hear this story, it seems kind of like a nice love story, right? And especially from our modern, maybe our Western lens, we're really rooting for Seijo, right? She bucked the patriarchy, yes! She followed her heart. She didn't follow societal and cultural conventions. Yeah, go Sei! You know. But now that we know the plot twist that happens at the end of the story, where there were actually two Seis, there was one sick in bed and one off in the faraway land with Ochu that had now come home on the boat, and as the two Seijos came together, they merged into one person again. Now that we know that, and we go back in time to when Ochu left on his boat, you can imagine this young man rowing down the Yangtze River, and here's this figure running along the riverbank, and it's Seijo! Oh, how wonderful, she's decided to follow me. But we know, well, that's not the whole story. She may be running along the riverbank and boarding his boat and going off to this faraway land and raising children with him and all that, but there's a Seijo that's homesick in bed with Chokan too, that is barely moving and hasn't spoken to a soul in years. It is like a shell of a person. So, are we still rooting for her? Did she make the right decision? Is what we're getting at. She had a choice. Do I stay with my father in this village and fulfill my filial responsibilities, my cultural societal responsibilities? Do I follow my respect for my father? Do I honor that and do what he's asking me to do by marrying this other man? Or do I follow my heart and I go with my true love and I go with Ochu and we build a life together? She was faced with this choice, and it seems like she made one choice as the story unfolds, but then as we get to the end, we realize she didn't really make a choice at all. She left one part of herself with Chokan and another part went off with Ochu. So has she really committed to either one in doing so? Maybe Ochu got the better end of the deal, right? But she's still not completely, totally, wholly present in either situation. And so in a way, we can fault her for taking the easy way out. Now, I put big air quotes around that because this idea of dividing yourself into two people and one staying here and one going there and one doing this and one doing the other thing doesn't sound very easy at all, right? And yet it's the choice that we often make in our lives. When we try to hold two competing, conflicting aspects of our life at the same time and try to give energy to both, and we often end up doing a disservice to everyone involved. She can't bring herself fully to either situation, and so both sides suffer. Maybe Chokan more. He's sitting there, you know, one day his beautiful daughter was going to marry another man. He thought all was well with the world. My role as a father is complete. I'm marrying off my daughter. Life is good. And then suddenly, his young nephew disappears, and his daughter takes ill to bed, not speaking and not moving. Poor guy, you can imagine how worried he must have been for his daughter's well-being. She certainly didn't marry the other man in that condition, right? And as any loving father would, he was probably more concerned about her personal well-being and her health. So we can go back to this moment and realize that when Seijo made a decision by not really making a decision at all, by choosing the third, quote-unquote, easy way out, what if she had made a decision, a solid decision, an outward decision? What if she had said to her father, Chokan, Dad, I know you want me to marry this other man, but I got to follow my heart. Ochu is my true love, and we're meant to be together, and I love you, and I respect you, but I can't go through with this marriage. Chokan would more than likely have been extremely upset, right? Might have been very angry. We don't get the sense in the story that he was the kind of father who would have said, fine, you're dead to me, I have no more daughter. He seems like a loving, caring father, so hopefully he wouldn't have had that response. But he would have been upset. But if she had done that, and she and Ochu had been able to go off and live their lives with a clear conscience, we did the right thing. We told my father, we expressed our intent, we expressed our wishes, and here we are now living our life. Chokan would have been angry and upset. He would have hurt for some time, probably. But is it possible he could have gotten over it and eventually come to terms with, okay, she's happy. I love my daughter, and her happiness is what's most important to me. She's happy with Ochu. Maybe the village that they lived in would have shunned them, perhaps, right? They might have had to move to a faraway offland anyway. But eventually people might have forgiven and forgotten. Or what if she had gone the other direction and said, I've got to do what Dad asked me to do. That was the cultural norm, right, of the day in that society, for her to actually follow through with her father's wishes rather than asserting her own intentions. And she had said to Ochu, I'm really sorry. I love you, but this is my responsibility. I've got to marry this other man. My father has arranged this marriage. Ochu obviously would have been very heartbroken. And in the story, we see he's committed to this reality already. That's the only way that this thing is going to go, as far as he's concerned. And so he says, forget it. I'm not sticking around for this. I'm getting on my boat and I'm leaving town. He fully commits to that version of the story. And it's only Seijo appearing on the riverbank that interrupts that version of events. But if Ochu had just been able to continue on down the river and move to a faraway land, heartbroken, of course, devastated, of course, missing his one true love, Sei, would he have eventually gotten over it? Well, sure, he would always pine for her or maybe always have a soft spot in his heart for his first true love. But he probably would have eventually grown and evolved, changed. Maybe would have even found somebody new to love and entered another relationship. So had she committed to one version of events or the other, there would have been pain. Of course, there would have been pain. But was the pain of trying to keep everything in limbo worse? And in a way, it was. Chokan's pain probably lasted much longer. His daughter Sei, day after day after day, in bed, sick, not speaking to anyone, worrying about her health, having no idea what was going to happen next, no idea what the outcome was going to be. And Ochu and Seijo in a faraway land, seemingly happy, raising a family, getting married, all this type of thing, but that lingering regret, that lingering shame, that lingering doubt at how they had left things back home with Chokan. And Seijo probably, as she was living in this faraway land raising kids, probably felt something's just not right. And you get the hint of that there at the end of the story where she feels like, I didn't realize that I was still at home in bed. I followed him and it kind of all felt like a dream. An unsustainable choice that she made. Something had to give and eventually did. So she had a hard choice to make and she ended up not making it. She kind of took the easy way out. And if she had made the hard choice, there would have been pain. But would the eventual outcome have been better than it actually was? Probably. So why do we struggle with making hard choices like this then? I don't know about you, but in my experience, having been faced with more than a handful of hard choices of this, not of this exact nature, but I've never had my soul leave my body and follow another person, as far as I know. I don't know. Maybe I have. Maybe I'm sick in bed somewhere right now. But in my experience, it really comes down to one thing and one thing only. What in the business world we call the WIFM. What's in it for me? Ego identity. Selfish desires. Selfish needs. Fear. And self-preservation. I've got hard choice in front of me. Neither one of them looks particularly attractive. Something's going to be devastating. Either way I choose, it's lose-lose situation. I avoid making that choice because I'm afraid. If I choose this, this is going to die. If I choose this, this is going to die. I don't want either one to happen. I'm afraid of the potential outcomes of either choice. And so I'm just going to not choose. How's that? I'm going to try to keep everything chugging along as normal and just hope for the best and keep a smile on my face and hope everyone's satisfied and everything is satisfied and hope that it all works out. But it rarely does. It rarely lasts for long, if it lasts at all. So it's this fear of the unknown outcome of making a choice and assuming the worst. And what's even more problematic about this is we often think, well, I'm trying to save them from pain and suffering. I'm looking out for them, you know, any people that may be involved or situations or potentialities. Well, by not making a hard choice, I'm actually helping them. But are you really helping by not making a choice and trying to keep things chugging along? Fear of an unknown outcome. Fear of what's going to happen if I do make a choice. And oddly enough, assuming the worst. Why would we assume the worst? If I make this decision, this is going to suffer and it's going to be horrible. Why am I so convinced that it's going to be horrible? How many times in your life, I know this has happened to me many times, have you made a decision or somebody's made a decision for you? That's the bigger one, I think. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is the end of the world. This is terrible. This is the most awful thing that could have happened. And now you look back on that years later and you say, that was foolish. I would not be sitting here celebrating my wedding anniversary today if truly every single relationship I'd ever been in that ever ended and I was like, oh my gosh, my heart is broken. That was my one true love. And now I look back and say, well, that was a bunch of BS. I'm really glad that that absolutely horrible, heartbreaking decision was made. It was painful at the time, but man, am I glad that it happened. In the commentary to the Koan, Mumon uses a really great visual. I love this visual. When he says, you're jumping from one husk to another. I actually imagine like ears of corn, and I'm a ear of corn, I'm jumping into another husk now. You know, kind of cute. Makes me laugh. And obviously, what he's really referring to there on an absolute, ultimate level is the cycle of rebirth and death, right? I'm done with this husk, and now I'm going to move on to the next one. My karmic energy pushing me forward from one life to the next. My constant cycling through samsara is pushing me on. But of course, that doesn't have to be exclusively on a cosmic level, right? It could also be just day by day, moment by moment, jumping from one husk into another. And it's okay if it's just, well, I'm this person at work, and I'm this person at home, and I'm this person to my friends, and this person to my family. Okay. But is it all you bringing yourself to each one of those situations? Or is it something else? Are you trying to be too many people at once? We have to all play different characters, play different roles. And the other allusion he made in the commentary, a traveler moving from one inn to the next. We all have to do that. I can assure you that the person that I am to my wife is not the person sitting here in front of you right now. Yeah. She would probably smack me if I tried to talk to her this way. Yeah. It happens occasionally. She's complaining about work, and I'm like, no, honey, blah, 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 blah. And then I get the look, you know, the look. So, but we have to be different people. We have to play different characters, different roles. And if we can achieve balance and bring our authentic selves to all of them, then great. But it can get really unsustainable when we're trying to be everything to everyone. We try to be everything to everyone. It's really easy to forget who we really are. And Genjo Koan, Dogen, says, I had the quotes in here and then I found the book. It's like, oh, it's better to read out of the book than my memory. Carrying oneself towards all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. All things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. And then just a couple stanzas later, the very famous line that we all know and love, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. And to be verified by all things is to let the body and mind of self and the body and mind of others drop off. And of course, you know, Dogen is talking in really lofty terms here, but can't we apply this to our day-to-day existence too? Am I carrying myself into situations from a place of fear, from a place of ego, from a place of selfish desire? And therefore, kind of creating a different aspect of myself for this situation that maybe isn't relevant to other parts of my life. Kind of dividing myself into two a little bit. And if it just, if those two aspects of my life just keep pulling and keep pulling and keep pulling, I'm going to wind up in the same situation that Seijo was in. Having to make some kind of a really, really hard choice that the outcomes are going to seem terrible on either side. So how can we allow all things to come forth through ourselves rather than trying to carry ourselves forward? How can we know when is it best to go with the flow of reality as it is presenting itself, as it is actually manifesting in our lives, rather than trying to manipulate and coerce and force the world to be what we want it to be? Do I force the world to match my ego, my perspective on the way things should be, or do I allow the myriad things to be themselves and I carry myself, or I allow those to carry myself forward? How can I bring my true authentic self to every situation, every interaction as it actually is, rather than asserting my ego and trying to manipulate and force? Because the true self, the authentic self that allows the myriad things to come forth, that self isn't interested in selfish desire. That self isn't interested in what we're afraid of and what we're not afraid of. That self has no fear. That self isn't concerned with its own agenda. It's not afraid to bear witness. It's not afraid to make hard decisions and let the outcomes be what they need to be, knowing that their decisions are going to be of benefit to everything, everyone involved, even if it may cause temporary pain and suffering. Our entire practice centers on exactly this type of hard choice. Siddhartha Gautama, when he was still a young prince of the Shakya clan, had to make a hard decision. He'd seen the four signs. He'd seen sickness, old age, and death, and then a monastic who had achieved enlightenment. He said, well, I don't want those other three, and I do want that fourth one. So how do I get there? I'm a prince. I've got a wife. I got a kid. What am I supposed to do? Do I stick with my princely duties and stick with my family? Or do I follow this calling I have to shave head and beard and don the ochre robes, to use the old sutra language, and go forth into homelessness and try to figure out, what does this mean? Depending on the version of the story that you read, he either, you know, jumped the castle wall in the middle of the night and said bye-bye, didn't even say goodbye, which doesn't paint him in the most charitable light, or he expressed his desires to his family and they said, well, his poor dad, you know, as the story goes, his dad had visited a sage, and the sage said, well, your son's either going to be a great king or he's going to be a great seer, a teacher. And dad was like, well, forget that last one. I want him to be a great king, so I'm going to make sure his life is, you know, dad was trying to manipulate the situation to suit his ends, and it ended up not working. Siddhartha was like, see you later, dad. Shaving head and beard and going into that homeless life that you didn't want me to go into. Shows you how much some of our manipulations really can help. But, you know, in other versions of the story that are more charitable, of course, he tells his family what he wants. He makes the hard decision in the way that Seijo could not. He didn't try to, well, so let's see. I'll come back to the palace at night. I'll have dinner and hang out with the family. And then during the day, I'll go be a monk. You know, some homeless dude begging for alms. And then I'll come back and I'll put on a wig and a beard. And whatever. I don't know. You could paint all sorts of crazy stories. He didn't try to keep both. He made a decision. And he made the decision from a place of no fear, no identity, no ego identity, no selfishness. What is needed? What is the next right thing to do? It's going to cause pain. Somebody's going to get hurt. But in the end, is that hurt going to be less than the other hurt? Is that hurt going to be less than trying to keep both of them balanced? And he did. He went forth into homelessness, and it seems like his family forgave him. His wife and his son and his stepmother had, you know, they ordained and became enlightened themselves. So there you go. It was win-win for everybody involved. Right? He was seeking his own enlightenment, but also seeking enlightenment for the sake of all beings. This was the way to end suffering. And yes, I have to leave my wife and kid, but I also have to alleviate all suffering, right? And aren't we glad that he made that decision? So, how do we do this? How do we make these hard choices? I don't know about you, but I've had a couple of these in my life. You know, the biggest one for me most recently was I got my family and my job over here, and I had my career as a professional musician over here. And I mean, like, I was leading a band and doing all the bookings and all the rehearsals, and I was playing in like six other groups, and then I was taking freelance work, session work, and movie soundtracks and albums. I was just crazy. So in my case, it was like actual busyness, like amount of time and energy being devoted. It's not always that. It wasn't that in Sejo's case either, but I had to choose. Life came calling and said, what are you going to do? Because I was too afraid to say, well, I either need to fully commit to this or I need to fully commit to these. Nah, I don't want to fully commit to either one. I want to have them both. I want to have my cake and eat it too, as the saying goes, right? And so I just kept trying to balance and just give a little bit of myself here, a little bit of myself there, dividing myself into two separate people. And it wasn't enough for anybody involved. Certainly my family, my employer, but also all the people that I was working with, they weren't getting the full James either. And when life finally came knocking and said, you know what? Knock it off. You can't do this anymore. I made the hard choice. Or I had the hard choice kind of made for me in a way, right? The choice I wasn't strong enough or brave enough to make. The choice that I didn't want to make out of a sense of fear and selfish desire. I wanted to continue to try to manipulate life to match what I wanted it to be. Life said, forget that, man. I ain't going to cut it anymore. And so I chose. And I chose my family and my job and, you know, that side over the... And I quit. I just quit everything. Quit the group I was leading. Said, sorry, guys, I resign from my post. Emailed all the guys that would call me for gigs and said, I'm not available to take work anymore. Bye-bye. Quit cold turkey. And then had to figure out a way. How can I still be a musician? How can I still do this without, you know? And I think I figured that out. But the only way that we can do this is to stop coming from a place of the whiffin. What's in it for me? And start looking at it from the lens of what's the best thing to do for everyone involved. And so for me personally, there's two questions that really help me if I'm faced with any kind of hard choice. There's two questions that I can ask myself that help me come to the right decision. Which choice is about me? How can I get myself out of the way? How can I put the me away? My own selfish desires, my own fears, my own desire for self-preservation. Which often is, well, what am I holding on to here? What am I trying to keep going with by trying to balance two competing and conflicting aspects of my life? What am I holding on to here? What am I afraid of? And how important is it really? It seems important, but if I get some objectivity and back up from it, is it really that important? In my case, it was, do I really need to be out there every weekend on stage being the superstar? You know, the guy that everybody wants to book and listen to and all that? Actually, no. That's actually not all that important. How about that? 30-odd years of thinking that was important, and it's actually not. Okay. Now what? You know. So how can I get myself out of the way and come from a place of concern for all rather than a concern for me? And the other really important one and really helpful one for me is, which choice, if I had to choose, which one is in alignment with the precepts and my vow? Which choice is going to ask me to be dishonest with myself and others? Which choice is going to ask me to be selfish and take what's not mine? Which choice is going to require me to, the teaching on the eight worldly winds, to praise self and blame others? Which one is going to require me to elevate myself at the expense of others? Well, that's probably the wrong choice. So I found that that's an extremely helpful little litmus test to bounce any decision up against. How much of myself is in this, and how can I get that out of the way, and is this in alignment with the precepts and the vow? And if it's not, then forget it. Any decision I have to make that would require me violating or bending precepts is not worth it. I mean, there's exceptions, of course. By and large, if we can do that, if we can come to hard choices with a less of a sense of self and allow the myriad things to carry us forward into the situation, hopefully we'll be able to be of benefit to all beings and alleviate suffering. So I'll leave it there. Questions, comments? The cloud or the dirt? Alice, hi.
Hi. How did it feel when you abandoned your musical career? How did it feel?
It was a big relief. But it was only a big relief because I'd already seen through it. If I was forced to give it up and I hadn't really seen through it, then it would have been really difficult, I think. But I had already come to the realization that, I've been faking it for decades. Like, this is not, I have friends that are not faking it. They love to like sit there and practice scales for 12 hours a day. And they take every gig that they can get and they're just happy to do it. And they're out there and they're doing their thing. And I'm like, I don't identify with that at all. You know, 9 times out of 10, when it was time to go to a gig, I was like, oh, do I really have to do this? You know, and that should have been a wake-up call. Like, this is not the life you're cut out for. You know, this is, you're not really doing this because you love it. It's not like some deep, you know, my muse wishes to speak. You know, that's not what it was about. It was about, oh, I get to be on stage and be the cool guy and be up there and entertaining people and be admired and respected and, you know, all that. So once I saw through that aspect of it, then I was like, oh, thank God I don't have to do this anymore.
So. Did you waffle after you made your decision? Did you go, oh, you know, could have done?
Not for a second.
Not for a second.
Yeah, literally not for a second. And what's interesting is that that decision and the relief that I felt and the realization that I had been giving myself to something that was just not really authentic, and now I could be authentic, allowed me to kind of settle back into a new place in my heart and mind and start to find a new way to be that eventually led me to the practice. I think if Buddhist practice had raised its head at all anytime earlier, I would have been like, crazy people bound to statues of the Buddha, what is this nonsense? You know, but because it came at just the right time when I already was trying to find authenticity, it was best decision I ever made.
Thank you.
All right, Jinryu, and then Bob.
Thank you, James, for this wonderful talk. It was very well put. And I thought it was a great example of how we can use the precepts as guidelines. And I also the first precept I thought about was the very first one, do not kill. Because I know in my own past, when I have been in a position to try to be all things to all people, it's killing me. I'm the one who suffers an awful lot. And to a point you just made, if I'm on the receiving end of someone who is trying to be all things to all people, I can tell it feels like a lie. It feels like someone's not dealing with me honestly. And the other thing it made me think about was the one on anger, which we're going to hear about Tuesday evening, which is do not contrive reality for the self. I think that's all I have to say, but it was really wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Bob.
Hi, James. This is actually a technical question. Is there any way you can arrange things so that we can put the person in the chair for Zendo?
Oh, okay.
I thought we had it all. Alice, hardly at all. Very low. And, great talk today. Thank you very much.
I could hear Alice well. I don't know if that goes for other people in the cloud.
I'll set the mic a little closer to mitigate. Dave. Thank you, Bob.
So what was the young lady's name? Sejo? Is that right?
I'm sorry?
The person's name, I forget.
Yes, the young lady in the story.
It occurs to me that none of us get to be happy Sejo. We don't get to go off and be happy and leave the sad part behind. I think that because we lack the ability to bifurcate ourselves, if we get to that crossroads and we fail to make a decision, we might not lose half, but we leave a little bit behind. And we just get sadder and smaller as time goes on. And I wonder how much of us have all of it, you know, and how much of us are operating on 85% and 5% here, 10% there, you know, or even more.
Yeah, there's a funny, funny is the wrong word for it. There's an interesting theory in, it's modern physics. I don't know if it's technically quantum physics, but it's that all potentialities exist simultaneously. And then at the point that you make a decision, they all collapse into the one. And then that now immediately sets up a whole new set of infinite possibilities. Right? And then you're just constantly... Infinite possibility is the one. Infinite possibility is the one. Infinite possibility is the one. And I think you got a great point there. Like, I think at every point that we make that decision and it collapses to the one, there's something that we left behind. Is that a good thing? I mean, we've all probably left pieces of ourselves behind in different aspects of our life that I'm really glad that's gone. You know, and then there's probably aspects that I'm kind of sad that they're not there anymore too. But yeah, that's an interesting point. And do we, when we leave that piece of us behind, do we grow a new limb to take its place? You know, or are we always just chipped away at? That's an interesting point I'll have to think about. Thank
just
you, Dave.
Riff off of that, you know, it's like
I can hear you back here. You can talk to the mic, and I can hear
sorry.
You.
It's interesting. That's an interesting point, and kind of to riff off of that, like how do you reclaim that 5%, that 10%, that 15%, either known or unknown? Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting. I don't wonder if I do wonder if the act of simply being cognizant of that is in and of itself enough. If we're leaving pieces of ourselves behind and we're not aware of it and we're not seeing it and we're not acknowledging it, I wonder if that leads us down a path of ignorance that maybe Sejo had to have in that story, right? Where she even said, I didn't know. I didn't even know I was at home sick in bed. I followed Ochu as if in a dream. You know? Are we living in a dream or are we living in reality? Yeah. So, interesting point. Thank you both for that. That's good. Jinryu.
Yeah, I'm It is a very interesting question, and I'm on Sejo's side in this one. It's put me in mind of faith in mind, which is what we studied in our last retreat. And it's like the past is in the past. Where I'm supposed to be is 100% here right now, 100%. That's all.
Yeah, thank you. Katie?
Well, there's this sort of new school of psychology that's called internal family systems. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it's like basically acknowledging that we're all multiple personalities. And so the people who use that actually are working with different parts of yourself. Like, I mean, it's unusual for something to be so completely two parts, like in that story. That would almost be like a, like something like disassociation. Well, it is actually. Yeah. It's a great story. I loved it. And but the thing is, like, we all have a lot of parts to ourselves. And one of the things that a therapist working with that system, they'll be kind of introducing parts that, you know, that are a little buried because you don't want them coming up, you know, and it's very interesting. But and I'm certain that somebody using that system could probably come up with some really wonderful stories that would function in the same way that yours did. I thought that was really a neat story.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting if you read that, the commentary on that a particular koan, of course, they're coming at it from a little more of an absolute, you know, dharmic perspective.
Absolutely.
And of course. But yeah, it's interesting to think about all of this in that light as well. You know, mm-hmm. how much of this, you know, existence are we bringing? Or that's why I love the parallel there with the Genjo Koan quote. Is how much of this is me making something that I think isn't there and needs to be there, and how much of it is just me allowing things to make themselves, you know, and present themselves. And I think, you know, like you said there, it's, there are times when you got to be different people. And I admire people very much who can actually be 17 different things and still bring enough energy to all of them. You know, like, to me, that's like very much enlightened activity right there. You know, the person that comes to mind right away is like Joan Halifax Roshi. She's the abbess of the Upaya, and she's a doctor, and she does the Doctors Without Borders thing. And she can be all things to all people, but I don't think she's ever could be accused of being inauthentic in any of it. You know?
Well, that school too of psychology believes in an authentic self.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know it when you're there. Yeah. That kind of,
That's wonderful.
It's very interesting.
That's wonderful. What was it called again?
Internal Family Systems.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'll have to read about that some more. It's fascinating. All right. Sarah.
Hi, James. I loved your story. I'm new to the group. This is my first meeting with you all and my first Zazen session. And I was thinking as you were telling your story I think I got lost when you were addressing concepts of the self, multiple sides of the self. I don't know if this is a difference in how Zen views the self compared to other schools of Buddhism, but I just feel lost there. And I'm sorry if this is a stupid question, but what do you mean? Different aspects of the self, which can compete with one another, and, you know, where you have to kind of decide which part of yourself to satisfy. Isn't that the ultimate goal, to release from any concept of the self, but I might be wrong. I don't know.
Well, you got another 2 hours because that's...
I'm going too deep.
You just asked probably the most perplexing, most complicated question in all of Buddhist practice. Okay. And I'm certainly not qualified to give you a solid answer on that. But from my perspective, and anybody out there that knows better than me is welcome to offer an alternate viewpoint. But yeah, in Buddhism, there is a very strong focus on, in general, right? Buddhism in general, no self, right? Anatta, which isn't, I think the word no self is a little misleading because it doesn't mean that you don't have a self or you're trying to get rid of self. It's that you're trying to live into kind of what we've been talking about right now, which is a really truly authentic self that is not predicated on the three poisons of greed, anger, and ignorance, right? That is responsive rather than reactive. Maybe it sounds like those are the same thing, but they're not. I think.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in Zen and in the other Mahayana traditions, a very, very strong focus on bringing that self to help all sentient beings. Very much living by vow of trying to be of service to Sangha, which in this case, Sangha meaning literally all sentient beings anywhere and everywhere. You know, and I think on a more practical level, and kind of the way that I was saying it in the talk is, I think an inauthentic self is a self that's predicated on selfish desire. You know, I want, where it's not cognizant of what the impact of that might be on others, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another version of self that could be used unskillfully and might be inauthentic is a sense of self that's predicated on division of me versus them, self versus other, right? Like, well, I am this, and I am more authentic and real and valuable than that person.
Mm-hmm.
Those are just a couple of examples, and that probably was a terrible explanation.
But I think I understand, yeah. So like transcending the ego part of self, you know, that which attaches and is, you know, experiences aversion and those, that level of suffering doing that to consider your vows and your precepts. I appreciate your explanation. It helps me understand. Thank you.
And the real trick there that I, and again, this is just my perspective on it, is how do you transcend the self and you set the you know, transcend ego, set the ego identity aside, but not try to get rid of it. Because not only is that completely impossible, but it's not skillful either, right? So it's finding that balance between just enough ego identity to function in the world and still be a person, right? But to use that identity skillfully to let go of the self, mm-hmm. right? So kind of using what's wrong, and I put big, big, big air quotes around that, but using what's wrong with us to find what's right with us and then setting all of it aside eventually, right? But then always coming back to that, like even the most fully enlightened person on the planet is of absolutely no use to anyone if they can't come back into regular life. And, you know, there's a lot of little anecdotes in Zen parlance, you know, before enlightenment, you chop wood, you carry water. After enlightenment, you chop wood, you carry water, right? You still have to be able to come back from some, you know, highly ethereal, enlightened state of freedom and bliss and all that, and still come back and do the freaking laundry, man. You know, like, so being able to find that perfect balance is, I think, what a lot is. I think Zen in particular focuses a lot on that aspect of it. So. But again, I'm not the most qualified person to expound on that. Anything else? But thank you, Sarah, and welcome. It's great to have you. You hear a lot more wisdom from our teacher, Domyo, when she comes back. So come back. She's great.
nobody wants to go, I can follow up.
Please.
I mean, when Betty Eric asked that question, I know, I don't know the answer, but I know the answer for me. It's because when I found myself in a place where I felt I was missing most of myself, I managed to get around it, I think, by coming to the realization that you cannot actually do that. You don't leave yourself behind. You're still all here. Mm-hmm. What you've done is you've taken something on, and you're the one that's carrying it. Mm-hmm. And once you realize that, at least when I realized that, you can see through it and leave it. So what feels like that lack is actually something you're carrying, you know. Yeah. But that's my answer.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great. That's great. I think there's even was a metaphor for is it? Well, it's Maitreya Buddha, but there's a different imagery. I can't think of what it is, but he's carrying a sack, and you just keep taking things out of the sack and that you're carrying, the load you're carrying, and you set it down to make a stone. The path that you walk on. I think that's a really apt metaphor for what you just said. You just keep taking that load off your shoulders, set it down, and use it to progress further. I love that. Thank you. Okay, well, there's nothing else then. I'll give you 5 minutes of your day back, or 4 minutes, or whatever it is. All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is clear and moves beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha Prajna Paramita.
Good job.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.